I'm here to talk about resumes. My name is Nadine Miller, and currently I work at Oak Ridge National Lab as a cybersecurity engineer. I just moved to that position. Before I was an information security engineer, I was a system administrator. Before that, I was a trainer, course developer, and technical writer. I still do a lot of technical writing, obviously. It goes with the territory. But my background is not in engineering or computer science or any of that stuff. I am an English major. And I wound up in tech because I worked in a computer lab in college. And I realized that if I didn't get my PhD in English, I wasn't really going to be able to make a living as an English major. So it is what it is. So the thing I want to emphasize today is we're not going to be talking about the fluffy stuff like typography or how to format your resume or whether your resume should be two pages or one page or whatever. What I'm going to talk about today is just the content aspect of it. I do have more slides to talk about that stuff if we end up having time, run out of questions, that sort of thing. But really, this is about mining your career for the achievements and accomplishments and the actions to build content that's appropriate to the audience that a resume is for, and helping you get into the mindset of seeing the bigger picture of what managers and gatekeepers want to see to make it more likely for you to get a job interview. So a resume audience is generally one of two sets of people. You're either going to be going through what I call the human resources recruiter gatekeepers, or you're going to be going directly to a technical manager or someone that you know on a tech team that you give your resume to. So these two groups have very different kind of approaches, because generally recruiters do not have a technical background. There are rare exceptions, but in general they're not going to have a technical background, and so they get this list of requirements and then we get buzzword bingo, right? As I like to say. You also have the second set of folks, technical manager, hiring team. Hopefully they know what the role's requirements are. They don't always. Sometimes they will actually be able to read between the lines on a resume that's perhaps not as perfectly designed as resumes should be. So those are the two audiences that you have to deal with. And really, as much as you can, you should try to get your resume in front of these people, because they're the ones who actually are going to understand your experience in a way that most HR recruiters are not. So my question for you is, what do you actually think the purpose of a resume is? Anybody willing to offer up their comments? This is really, I think, the perspective that everyone needs to understand. Your resume is nothing more than a marketing document. It's like going to a trade show and talking to the folks in the booths and getting flyers. Right? The reason why they create those marketing materials is they're trying to get you to call them back so that they can engage you face-to-face for sales, right? And that's what your resume needs to be. So it's very important to change your perception of a resume. It's not a gigantic historical document. It should be targeted to the kind of job that you're looking for. You should groom it all the time It's not something you should just work on when you're looking for a job. It's something you should be working on all the time. And here is the thing we're going to focus on most today. Strong content trumps everything else. So what is strong content? Let me show you an example of probably... This is sort of an example that I'm trying to use to draw an analogy between a lot of resumes that I've seen and help people work on. A lot of folks, I mean, you look at this, it's very vague. It doesn't give any distinct claims. It is what they call in the marketing world, weasel words. And a lot of folks, when they write the resumes, they do the same kind of things. This is another example of failed marketing. 2007, $300 million ad campaign by Microsoft that was pulled after the second commercial because it received such bad publicity. You know, they say there is no such thing as bad publicity, but in this case, there was. This was a marketing campaign for Visa. No one could figure out from the commercials what this they were actually trying to sell, right? So when it comes to your resume, you want to avoid that because at best you have about 90 seconds to get past the gatekeeper. So the number one problem is that authors of resumes don't demonstrate their value. They generally have a laundry list of job duties or technical buzzwords. They discuss their experience in the most vague way you can imagine, right? And the thing that you have to keep in your mind all the time is that it's nothing for the person reading your resume to take it and throw it in the trash. They have no investment in throwing it away. And so you need to be able to highlight the things that make you special. I mean, you know, we talk about not being the special flower, not standing out, being that problem child, but when it comes to your resume, you actually want that. So you got to concentrate on results because results equal value. And when you're reviewing the information, the things that you have done in your career, you want to think about the actions, the accomplishments, the achievements and awards that you've received, the attaboys, the comments that you've received from your clients about your performance, the comments that you've received from your manager about your performance. Results need to be specific and quantitative and relevant. A lot of times, well, here recently, I was helping someone with a resume who doesn't work in technology, and this person included, it was a woman, this person included information in her resume about why she left the job. Now, I saw a couple of grimaces out there. Not everyone knows that's a faux pas. Right? That's information that other people don't need to know. So, relevancy. This also leads to the issue of, should I have multiple resumes? If you're looking for different job targets, yes, you should. In fact, there are people who will tell you that you should handcraft your resume for every job that you apply to. And if you really want to be successful and have a very targeted job search, I would say that is in fact the case. You can be successful without doing it, but if you have really strong ideas about what type of company you want to get into, I think that handcrafting your resume for every application is a good idea. So when we talk about specifics, we mean free from ambiguity. We want to avoid weasel words, which, you know, equivocation. Avoid vagueness. The a list of weasel words here: standing alone without action support. So if you use these words and you add action with them, it's okay. But when they're by themselves, they don't have any strength to them. Quantitative. When you start talking about numbers and measurable actions, you increase specificity. You show the reader that you have an understanding of how your work fits into the larger picture of the workplace, be it from a business perspective or the rest of the team, or how your actions contribute to the overall reliability of the business, so on and so forth. And then on the issue of relevancy, you want to target the specific skills and experience that are in a given job description, or if through your efforts at networking you meet technical managers that you know have job openings, you want to try to figure out what they're looking for before you hand them your resume so that you can craft it to fit that. It may be useful to include things on related or competing technologies, though, as well, because in a lot of businesses, just because they're looking for someone who, say, knows Oracle, they may be considering moving to an open source database system. So if you also have experience with MySQL or Postgres or something like that, including that on your resume may give you a leg up over other candidates. So the reason why we want to be more specific is to highlight your key experiences, because that shows your value. It's easier for the audience. As I said, attention spans are limited. There's some argument that humans have the attention span of goldfish these days. And when you're explicit, when you give all those details, you have less opportunity for miscommunication about what you really know how to do, which can be very important when you get into an interview, especially if it turns into a technical deep dive type interview. So some examples of vagueness versus weasel words. I've actually seen stuff like this on resumes. Manage large infrastructure versus something like built and maintain 1,200 servers. Supported end users versus provided email and ticket support to 300 internal users, right? These are examples of using numbers to increase specificity. Improved system reliability versus implemented HA server infrastructure using F5 load balancers. Analyze web server performance versus analyze web server performance and implemented Memcached to reduce client load times. So how do you get from vague to specific? Well, you look at your career history. Some things to always do. You want to look at your email archives. I'm sure we've all spent that. We probably do that pretty regularly when people say, oh, what about that decision we made 6 months ago? Look at your annual reviews. Hopefully you have actually worked at places where you get performance reviews. One thing that I always do, even if my boss does not require it, is that I write a daily or a weekly work log. And it doesn't matter whether someone else is going to see it or not. It helps me remember all the things that I've done over the course of a year when it comes time for me to write my performance review or when I'm working my resume. Any other work-related documents that you might generate, be it documentation, project reports, testing reports, those things are good to mine for details that you can put into your resume. awards for excellence, recognition for going above and beyond. Maybe you helped somebody after hours that their issue was not really something that normally would be dealt with. Kudos from clients, nothing like getting an attaboy. Especially important for like LinkedIn, contact those folks and get them to give you kudos there. Unofficial actions affecting others. I was in a job situation when I worked at XM Satellite Radio. There was a Pulitzer Prize winner. You folks may have heard of him. His name is David Pogue. He was a XM Satellite Radio client, and he was mad about the fact that he couldn't use streaming on his Mac. Technical support told him that it wasn't possible. They didn't support it. He was mad enough that he called the president of our company. And because my group, who was responsible for the external website, were the only folks in the entire company that knew anything about Macintoshes, my boss told the president that he would check with his team to find out if it was actually the case that he couldn't use it on his Mac. That was at the time that Flip for Mac had just been created, and so I sat down and had an email exchange with David Pogue and explained to him how he could install this third-party plugin for QuickTime and use it in his browser to be able to access the website, and told him, you know, if he needed any further help, that he could contact me. And as a result of that, I ended up changing the standard operating procedures for customer support in my organization. I had nothing to do with that organization, but yet something that I did unofficially on the side changed everything. So this is the kind of thing you have to think outside of the box. And that gets put on my resume, even though it's not really relevant to anything that I do. It shows people that I'm willing to go above and beyond to get the job done. And that I understand my place in the business is not just to be a head-down sysadmin solving internal problems. I have a perspective that looks at the business as in the larger context, right? So I would encourage you to step back from your relationship with your work to try to see the bigger picture in your career. You may also do things that you don't get paid for, which you have skills from. Leadership skills, technical skills, because maybe you have hobbies that lead you to do things that you can't do at work. We've had some discussions here already today about people who work in open source software who have done things for free, and it's leveraged into their career and helped them advance. Maybe you do part-time consulting on the side. All of those things matter when it comes to job hunting, and you should put them on your resume. So some questions to ask yourself to help break out of that head-down kind of focus. What is the impact of your work on the business as a whole? When you're working on something, what is the overall importance of a project or a task to other people on your team, to the business as a whole, maybe other groups? How did you do it? How long did it take you? These are questions to help you figure out the numbers. Who directed you or partnered with you? You may not understand the relationship of what you're doing to the overall path of the business, but by asking questions of people that you work with that maybe you don't understand all the things they're doing, you can get the larger context. What resulted from your efforts? Did you help the build team produce more builds? Did you reduce downtime? Did you increase or decrease the number of tickets that had to be dealt with? Think about savings, time, money, effort, automation, simplification, increased reliability, virtualization, conversion to open source software. All of these things can lead to savings of one sort or another. And if you can quantify them and put them down in your resume as numbers, this shows that you have a perspective that goes beyond most techies. Maybe the things that you do in your job increase sales or service renewals. Automation and completion of projects can do that. Increased reliability in your infrastructure can do that. Improved customer satisfaction can do that as well. Other savings come from efficiency increases, more done in less time. Maybe you built a build process that made it so that you could kickstart servers in 15 minutes instead of 2 hours, so you could completely rebuild a data center in a matter of days as opposed to a matter of weeks. Maybe you offloaded work by providing automation that allowed customers to do self-service. A lot of folks don't like to pick up the phone and call people. I mean, I know I don't. I'm standing up here and talking to you guys, but really I'm an introvert, so if I can do everything through the website and never have to talk to a person, that makes me happy. So that means your customer support staff can focus on other things, right? If the customers can self-service themselves. Customer satisfaction, reduced time to resolution, increased reliability, security improvements, all of these things affect relationships with internal and external clients. And if you can quantify them, then they are the perfect fodder to put on your resume. Other things that affect consistent operations are also useful for your resume because in my experience, one of the worst things that happens at tech companies in IT is that no one ever documents anything. Unless there's a mandate or unless the bosses make it part of everyone's performance plan, people build stuff all the time and never write down the whys or the hows, or you know, they get hit by a bus and now the entire system has to be rebuilt because no one understands how it works. So if you like to write documentation and are good at it, lots of times that works wonders for getting interviews. Change in configuration management, also hot buzzwords today. Everyone wants to be able to manage 12, 15, 10,000, you know, 20,000 machines. You can't do that with, you know, network shells, although I still know people who are trying. And also change management processes, because a lot of industries now, you actually have to show that you have a change management chain of command, as it were. So if you're knowledgeable about putting that sort of, that aspect of configuration management in place, it can be very good for your career as well. So time equals money. Time savings translate into monetary savings. What I advise you to do is to, when you see things like in your work, like, you know, changing the build process from 2 hours to 15 minutes, if you can figure out how to quantify things like that in terms of money, it actually will have more impact. I suggest using an average based on salaries, you know, figure out what the average dollars per hour are. And it's okay to generate estimates. You don't have to be exact. You just have to be able to explain when you're in an interview how you came to those numbers. Again, it demonstrates your big picture thinking and your knowledge of how your work fits in to the overall business goals. So I'm going to show some before and after examples because I find when I'm struggling with my resume, before and after is the kind of things that help me. So this comes from a resume of a friend of mine who was in technology, became a teacher, and then was trying to get back into technology. And so the top is the before, obviously. It's funny to me, just as kind of an aside, this is not a woman's resume. This person is a close friend of mine that I've known since college. But it's really amazing to me how people struggle with crowing, I mean, with being open and complete about describing what it is that they do and what they're good at. It's like I've seen it a lot with women, but also with men, they don't want to brag about themselves, right? It's like they almost fear that someone is going to be, I guess it's, you know, people believe that maybe other people are going to think they're selfish because they're, you know, crowing about their accomplishments. But on your resume, you really have to get over that because that's the whole purpose of the thing, right? So in this case, you know, he basically kind of blew off this little hardware and software skills, you know, teaching at three private schools. And I asked elicitive questions to him, you know, and this is the same kind of questions you can ask yourself. So when you worked at a given place, what did you really do there? What was the worst thing that you had to deal with? Because sometimes the worst thing you have to deal with generates the best results because it's the most painful, right? When he told me that he started teaching hardware and software, then I started asking him questions like, did you develop the materials, or did you work for materials that other people made? Did you have to travel between all the schools? How old were the children? How many people were there in the classes? How big were the labs? Because obviously the more computers you work on, usually people are more impressed by larger infrastructures. And you know, this whole thing of rebuilding the entire mobile lab because of infrastructure problems in one day, I was like, yes, put that on there. Another example from his resume. In this case, he was dealing with a lot of really old hardware. Normally, I would not tell someone to put on their resume that they developed a plan for doing a migration if that plan was not ever completed. But in his case, because of the type of monetary savings that in the plan that he built, I thought it was appropriate, even though it was never implemented. The school board actually rejected it because it showed the kind of larger project-oriented attitude that was necessary, you know, for him to fit into a larger enterprise. Another thing that I think is really important, if you've worked at a company for a long time and you've had multiple jobs, I believe that you should put all of the titles that you've had at that workplace on your resume. In this case, right, he's done it with just three separate lines and given his full term and then how long he spent in each title. That shows that you're capable of growth and that you're interested in growing. In some cases, like in my case, when I was a younger system administrator, when I did this, I actually broke out each piece and talked about the specific things that I did for each job title, mostly because I had started out on a help desk, and then I had moved into system administration, and then I had become a manager. But in this case, because his experience was quite a while ago, lumping it all together and only picking out key parts that highlighted some of his best skills from that was a better approach for him. So this is a before example from a colleague of mine named Lee. Lee basically completely rebuilt the infrastructure for this company that this blurb is about. And to me, there's two big problems with this. One, there's no numbers, and two, this is just a big wall of text which no one's going to read. They're going to skim the first two lines, and that's it. So this is how it was rewritten. You'll see that he's added quite a lot of numbers. He's broken it out into a bulleted list. There's still a couple problems with this, and he's since revised it even further. But this version shows just how much impact he had on this business in a way that the first one does not, right? He basically completely revolutionized how they approach building servers and managing their infrastructure. Again, another example from Lee's first resume, the wall of text problem. So here also, a lot more numbers, a lot more understanding of automating infrastructure. Here he's also started managing network infrastructure with that kind of automation skills, showing that he's not just concentrating on internal infrastructure by talking about external website traffic and doing performance management for that. Talking about his leadership skills. So some other things that you need to consider when you're writing a resume in terms of content. Stuff you want to avoid. You don't want to include any potentially discriminatory information. And by this, I mean things like marital status, protected status. Unfortunately, we have to put our names on our resumes. So there are some things we can't get away from the discrimination aspect of. I mean, I guess we could all just start using our initials. I'd actually be interested to like partner with LinkedIn or another professional website to do split testing based on names and other things to actually get some real statistics about people who are looking for candidates. You can't completely avoid dates, but I believe, especially if you're an older professional, that it's really important. Once you're past 10 years of experience, you really don't need to put all of your experience on your resume anymore. And if you do so, you're kind of giving away too much information about yourself. I've seen people my age, I'm older than I look, do things like indicate when they graduated from college. Not a good idea. If you're fresh out of college, that's a different story, because there's very little bias about hiring young people. There is bias about hiring older people. But on some level, especially if as a younger person you've had a lot of experience doing open source work and other types of work for nonprofits where maybe you didn't get paid, not putting your when you graduated from college on your resume might be a benefit for you, because it will look like you have more experience than perhaps you have paid experience. So that's something to consider. I've also seen people do silly things like put their disability status on the resume. Big no-no. In Europe, with CVs, in other countries with CVs, that sort of thing is accepted and, in fact, demanded. But in the United States, that is not how we do things here. Your resume is not a legal application. right? When you go to the job and they've made you the job offer and they ask you to fill out the application, that is a legal application. And at that point, you have to use the same titles that you had at your job and so on and so forth. Like, for example, when I worked for the Department of Education with a government contractor, my job title was computer scientist. I was not a computer scientist. I was a system administrator. My resume says system administrator, but when I fill out an application, I put down computer scientist. Yes, sir.
Do not ever say references available on request.
Yeah, it's redundant. Everyone knows that.
You'd be amazed how many I see.
Yeah, oh no, I meant in the sense of everyone knows they will be able to get your references if they ask for them. The only thing I'll say about style is that if you work in the technology industry, you should use a hybrid style. Chronological does not give the gatekeepers who are scanning for keywords enough quick information. So generally, my recommendation is you start with a profile, which is your 30-second elevator pitch. You then put down a bulleted list with broken into areas, especially like OSs, hardware, technologies, whatever titles you want to give it, that has your skills. Or if you want to highlight some special accomplishments, like, oh, I don't know, some big project that you completed that, you know, is perfect for the job that you're applying for, that would be a good place for it. And then you have a chronological history. A little bit more about profiles. This is the one place where you can really express your opinion about what your best skills are. 2 to 3 sentences. You want to target any kind of phrases in the job description that stand out to you and seem like a perfect fit with your experience set. This is a very strong opener. It's like the kind of thing that, you know, you hear all the time about businesses, right? You want to be able to summarize yourself in 2 to 3 sentences. Like, the thing I say about myself is that one of the phrases I use to describe myself is that I'm like the geek translator. I can go and talk to managers and explain complicated technologies and terminology that they can understand, but I can also have the technical conversation with the geeks, and I kind of bridge a gap of communication that often exists in organizations. So that's one of the things that I use. You might want to think about yourself and what makes you unique, the unique proposition, as it were. Skills list, again, gets past the gatekeepers, keyword list. It gives a technical manager, a technical person who is reading your resume an idea of the breadth of your skills. The other two things I want to say about this is relevancy. I don't think people want to know that you know how to use CPM or DOS or Fortran unless you're applying for a job that it's relevant to. And the other thing is that obviously there's a lot of folks who do it. They put down the kitchen sink hoping that they're going to use the shotgun method of getting job interviews. But if you can't answer questions about the things that are on your skills list, you probably should not put them on there. I also recommend that you keep a library of resumes. For a while, I was looking for system administration jobs. I was also looking for information security jobs. And I was looking for trainer jobs, because those are all things that I can do. And so I had multiple resumes. You want to continuously work on your resume so that you have it prepared before you actually need to look for a job. Length. Sort of touched on this before, but I think that it's okay to have a resume that goes past 2 pages. I think, assuming you have something on the order of at least 10 years of experience, or you've got a lot of projects or worked in a lot of different technology fields, as someone who has not been out of university very long, I think that going over a page to a page and a half is probably not a good idea. My resume right now is between 3 and 4 pages, and I actually think that's too long. People don't generally print out resumes unless they're coming to the interview and they want some paper in front of them, because it's kind of still not socially acceptable to bring your laptop to an interview, or your iPad or whatever. So length has become more irrelevant as people have stopped printing documents. But again, you know, length, having all those jobs with all those dates does leak data about yourself. In this context, what I mean by competitive intelligence, if you have spent time researching the companies that you are applying to, you may be able to infer and read between the lines and job descriptions to add more information that's appropriate to the job. And so if that is the case, then increasing, you know, the content of your resume because you have skills in that area is a good thing. So at this point, I wanted to open it up for questions. I can see that the post-lunch food coma is affecting some people.
Back to our digressive discussion from this morning. One of the things you said is you should be preparing your resume ahead of time, and that kind of conflicts with tailoring your resume to the job you're applying for. It's like...
Yes, that's true. When I say... So generally, what I tell people is that I create like a master document that has everything that I've been working on. And I actually use source code control for all my resume documents because I realized I was having this problem with they were breeding like bunnies. What I mean by that is not the specific resume that you're going to use to apply, but keeping that running master document up to date with the projects that you're working on and the results so that you don't forget stuff. It is so easy to forget that, oh yeah, I spent 36 hours in a room with, you know, 5 people from risk management dealing with the results of the Inspector General's audit last year or whatever, right? So.
And the other experience I would share with you is I was at a company for over 2 decades. And what I found is even within the company that my accomplishments were disappearing because the people who knew about them weren't there anymore. I mean, it's an interesting thing that you have to keep track, because they're not, you know, you can be a star and then, you know, you have to keep being a star and being a star and being a star. And then you have to keep track of that stuff because
yes.
I had a younger person explain to me how the security I designed worked incorrectly. And when I corrected them, somebody said, you know, a little possessive there, aren't you? And I said, I just feel that it's important to set the record straight.
So sometimes things need to be demonstrated.
But and I totally agree with your comment about I put maybe 20% of my experience on any one resume that goes, maybe 20%, because If it's not relevant to the job, they won't read it, and they'll, you know, think I'm boring, or they'll think I'm overqualified, which is just as bad. And I have my latest job mostly because I interviewed dumb at the interview, which had to do with I'm a PhD candidate, and I'm not looking for a PhD job. I'm looking for something that's in between that is not going to take all of my experience. So I had to take it off the resume and, you know, think, you know.
Yeah, there, I mean.
It's an interesting thing that you have to hide some, you know, it's not hiding, but, and it's not that I'm not proud of it or it's not accomplishment, but,
it's,
you know,
yeah,
matching.
It's an unfortunate thing that someone mentioned earlier today the entry-level position requiring 5 years of experience, or you know, the positions that expect 5 years of experience in a technology that's 2 years old, that kind of thing. The reality of it is that resumes are not the best way to get jobs. I think everyone, you have to have one, even if you have an in because people expect it. But really, and we can talk about this a lot more if you want, you know, networking is the way to go. And it's so much easier today than it was before. So anyway, Corey has a question.
First off, I want to second the idea of resumes under revision control. I just did an SVN log on mine and saw that the very first message I put on mine 4 years ago when I checked it in was, I should have checked this in a long time ago. But the awards listing on your resume, as somebody who looks at resumes a lot, I often have problems when people list awards that I can't verify or understand what the significance of them really is, just by the thing that's listed. And wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I can sort of relate to that. I'm pretty sure that if I list on my resume I don't even know what CAP stands for, the performance awards that I got when I worked at Cisco, that if you called up HR and asked, they would probably confirm it because they paid me money for those, so I'm pretty sure they're in the system. But, I can see where you're coming from. I guess that's, you have to kind of weigh it. I think it can have benefits, though. It depends on the situation, really. I don't put my CAP awards on my resume because I don't remember why I got a bunch of them. You know, it's not, at the time, it didn't seem like it was a big deal, so I never wrote it down, right? But other things, though, I mean, you know, like LOPSA gives out an annual award for, you know, the system administrators contributed the most to the community, things like that. Is more the thought process that led me to include that. And even if you don't actually put down the award, like in my situation, one of the CAP awards that I got had to do with moving data centers when I worked at Cisco. And so, you know, those might be reminders to you about, okay, something that you did which had a significant impact, and bringing that up as a detail in your resume if it was relevant, right?
How come this is so high? Got it now. You talked a lot about your resume and having different resumes and backup for different roles that you're going after, but oftentimes recruiters are looking at your resume that you have online in LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. So how do you manage the difference between what you're sharing publicly on an ongoing basis to what you're using to actually go to look for roles and jobs?
I think in that case, so with LinkedIn, because you don't have the opportunity to really target it like you would a paper resume that you're sending out, I think that you have to carefully craft that introductory paragraph to the thing that you want the most Which is oftentimes hard for people in technology. I don't know about you guys, but, you know, some days I don't want to do security. I want to do something else. Other days, you know, I would like to be a sysadmin again. So you have to make your choice. And if that perspective changes, then go and change it. Because the nice thing about LinkedIn is it's ephemera. You can change it at any time. I will say that I think it's really important. I don't really like this thing that they've introduced with the endorsements.
The new ones, yeah, that's crazy.
Because I think a lot of you, a lot of my colleagues at least, have some really unrealistic understanding of what it is that I know how to do.
Go to market, sales engagement, right?
Yeah, you know, like people think that I'm like a MySQL expert, and I'm like, yeah, no. I did databases a long time ago. I don't want to do that anymore. Stop talking about it. So I think that what's really key on LinkedIn is getting people that know you really well to endorse you and give you those little kudos. And if you can help them tailor that to whatever you're looking for, you know, at the current time, all the better, right?
Definitely. And change your photograph every now and then so people see you show up on LinkedIn as something changing from time to time. The other question I have is on, we're talking a lot about resume and the importance of it. How do you compare that to the information that you would include in a bio? Because I think a bio should be married as two forms that you deliver when you're sharing your resume. Do you agree, or you don't see them as two components?
So when you say bio, what do you...
It's really the shortened, highlighted version of who you are that reflects your career.
So, for example, I give a very different bio to Usenix when I teach a class like this than what I would use, you know, in that professional profile statement on my resume. But that's because I'm not doing something that normally would be associated with the type of jobs that I'm looking for, right?
Right. So it's just like a resume. You have different bios for different disciplines or different focus areas.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, all of us are pretty multifaceted, right? And just because you choose to focus on one thing because of a given an audience, that doesn't obviate any of the other things that you do. I will say that, you know, another way that you can really bring attention to yourself, and for introverts, this is probably kind of difficult, but being, you know, we all talk about social networking, and of course, all of us are aware of LinkedIn, but you can also, to be identified as a subject matter expert, you don't really need to be published anymore. You don't really need to even go to conferences and talk. All you need to do is give good information on a blog or in other venues to help your peers, and sooner or later people are going to recognize that you have skills, and then that can be leveraged as a kind of virtual networking to get the ends at places that you might want to work. That's how I got my job at ORNL. Yes, I still had to go through an interview, and I still had to, you know, get by the gauntlet of risk management, which is a pretty rough gauntlet. But I probably would not have been invited for an interview if I didn't know, you know, three of the people on my team. And I never met those folks face to face until like a year before I applied to the job. So there's a...
Thank you.
You're welcome. And it used to be we all talk about networking. It used to be that you basically had to be face-to-face to be able to network with people, and it's not like that anymore. Between Twitter and G+ and Facebook and LinkedIn and all the other social network sites that are out there, you can demonstrate your value pretty easily by answering people's questions, giving... not engaging in flame wars, but engaging in cogent commentary when people post blog posts and that sort of thing. The flip side of that is, you know, you there is a lot of noise in that system that you have to deal with, so it's important to filter and not let yourself get too overwhelmed by it. But it's definitely a lot easier to engage with colleagues now than it used to be. When I first started being a system administrator, basically all we had was mailing lists and Usenet. I suppose on some level I shouldn't admit this, but I wonder how I did my job before Google, right? There's so much information out there now that can be sifted through in a matter of minutes, when before you would, send out your plea for, has anyone ever seen this problem before, and hope maybe over the next 3 days that someone would respond. Of course, now we all are spied on 24/7, but that, it is what it is, I guess.
Hi. I had a question that it was pretty long. I had to write it down.
That's okay.
As a student, because you have to, what you were saying about tailoring your resume, but as a student, how do you tailor your resume if most of your experience, comes from short-lived internships while, as a student, you're just trying to get jobs to survive?
I can sort of relate to the whole short-lived thing because I've had a lot more jobs than a lot of people that I know. I think you have to, you're going to have to, on some level, try to read between the lines in the job description if there are things there that you don't have to see, specific technical skills to see if there's things that are related in your experiences as an intern. And then I would also encourage you to, if you know that there's a specific area that you want to work in, to go out there and seek out volunteer opportunities with open source projects or, locally in your technology community to try to bolster those skills further. The advantage of that, too, is through meetups and local LUG groups and that kind of thing, you often find out about jobs before they hit the internet, hit the job sites. And if you're a person who's been attending those meetings for a long time, a lot of people will take your resume and hand it off to the manager because they know you. And the known is better than the unknown. And I would encourage everyone to, on some level I dislike having to say this, but I think people have to be careful of their behavior in public, particularly when they're dealing with professionals that they may want to work with later. A lot of folks forget that people might not understand the context in which you're having a rowdy conversation with your friends, or maybe you had a little bit too much to drink, or anything else, any other potential negative behavior, and you have to consider how the folks who you're with in the environment might interpret that stuff. So, I hate to say it, but we should always be on our best behavior. Especially as women, just because, the internet is evil when it comes to women.
So I have a couple of questions around quantification, especially in terms of numbers. So there is this work that I've done a few years back, which we ended up getting multi-million-dollar deal for that. But at the same time, I'm not the person who has a running resume. I don't remember what it is. Is it 6 million, 8 million? I do not remember. So what would it mean in terms of quantifying it in the resume? Would I put in numbers or multi-million dollar deal?
I would say that I would use a conservative number. That's a tough one. you know, no one wants, I don't encourage anybody to lie about their experience, but if you know that it was a large number and, but you don't know the exact answer, I think it's okay to be conservative and put a number down. And if people quiz you about it, you know, you can be straight with them. The other thing I would suggest to you is that if you're still in touch with your colleagues who worked on those projects, send them an email or call them up and ask them.
So you still think putting in a number has got more value than saying it's a multi-million dollar deal?
Yes, I do.
Okay, that was one thing. The other thing is, again, I'm a person with more than 10 plus years of experience where I've worked in multiple places. Maybe my initial jobs right out of college or school might not be the bestest ones or anything. Would I still need to put dates on that? Because you brought in this interesting factor of age factor, or you might be overqualified for a job. It was very interesting, actually. Sometime back when I went for interviewing a job, they didn't give me, they said you were an ideal candidate, but you're not going to get this job because you're overqualified and we know that you're going to not stay here. It was an interesting reality. I'd never come across that before. But when you put in your job experience, are you saying that do not put in some of those old ones beyond your 10 years? They may not be really relevant to what I'm doing right now.
Well, I think it's a matter of relevancy, right? If you're trying to get a position where the skills that you learned at that job are relevant, or the accomplishments that you had, then I think it's okay to do that. And some people may not experience, you know, ageism. I mean, if you came out of school at 25 and you've been employed for 10 years and you've had progressively improving experience, you've been employed for 10 years. When you're 40, that's 15 years of experience. And ageism really doesn't kick in until you hit 50, 55. You know, so it's kind of a balancing act. You know, I'm careful about it because a lot of people, when I show up at a job interview, people think I'm a lot younger than I am. I turned 50 on my birthday. And so I don't want to give that away by, you know, writing on my resume things that I did in the 80s. You know, for me, that's a strategic advantage that I have, and I want to keep it for as long as I can. I'm not, you know, I don't want to give it away, right? And I mean, that sounds far more adversarial than I mean it to be, but you know, the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of corporations in the world who don't really have our best interests at heart, and so you kind of have to be that way, protect yourself. If you feel, I mean, I've been told that I'm overqualified, you know, frankly, if they tell me that, then I didn't want to work there anyway. And so one of the things that I do, especially if I'm dealing with a recruiter, it's not a job that I'm talking with a technical manager about, I'm going to ask him about salary right up front, because I don't want to waste their time. I don't want them wasting my time. And a lot of people will say, well, you shouldn't do that. But I have a certain level of expectation based on the amount of experience that I have, and if they're not willing to pay me in a way that reflects the reality of the market, then it's not a place that I want to work, because that tells me that they undervalue their employees.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, this is back to your topic about social media, because mm-hmm. I definitely have seen that as we have more people are going to the web, different ways of presenting yourself in a very public way with the advent of like Twitter, LinkedIn, and that's almost like your virtual resume. And this is probably more about like just a conversation. There's no right or wrong answer, but what is kind of your thoughts and feelings about having to almost manage your virtual, like, your virtual reputation? And also, kind of tie in with like how you were able to, you know, go on, be a blog post or be like almost an expert in a certain topic using this medium, but also kind of leveraging it too. And I was just kind of curious, like, how does that happen, is almost like this public persona going to become like your virtual resume that's very written for you?
Yeah, no, that is a balancing act. You know, some people have turned that whole personal branding thing into a career. One of my colleagues, Jesse Trux, he actually teaches a class called Blitzkrieg Branding. Personal branding is basically a way to market your expertise using social media, blogging, that sort of thing, right? So here's what I have to say about it. Yes, you have to manage your online reputation. I used to live under a rock. Actually, I had this conversation with a couple people at lunch today. There is a famous romance writer who has the same name as me. And so when I, you know, I would, okay, I hope everyone does this. You should go Google yourself. Google your full name, Google your name plus your initial, you know, various versions of it, and see where you show up. You know, 7 years ago when I Googled, there was like 10 pages deep of Nanny Miller, the romance writer. And I'm like, I know how the search engine results work. I'm not gonna be able to overcome that. Then I ran for the board of LOPSA, and suddenly I was on page 3. And which really surprised me. It led me to go do a bunch of research about LOPSA, and I found out they have a crap load of authority, and I was like, how did that happen? But you know, it's something you do. You really do need to try to control the results. And that's only to count, to at least be aware that there's negative, if there is negative information out there, to be aware of it. Maybe you don't want to run a blog. Maybe you don't want to do anything that has a high profile publicly with social media. But you at least need to be aware of those results. So if someone asks you about it, you can say, yes, I know, and that's not me. So I don't know about you guys, but I've had a lot of different jobs in the last decade. And search engine results are actually really cheap marketing for your expertise. There's a guy, his name is Matt Simmons. He writes a system administration blog, and as a result of, you know, slow effort over like 2 years, he's had a book deal. He became a blogger for the Lisa blog team, so he got his conference fees paid for. You know, so it can be not just a job hunting tool, but it can also kind of change your professional life in a way that maybe you didn't expect. So I would encourage you that if you're interested in that sort of public persona, that you go ahead and do it. You know, if there's a subject that you're passionate about in technology, but you don't have the ability to exercise that skill in your job, that's a great way to make a career transition.
And like, how about like verbiage or tone when you go maybe talk about a topic that you're really passionate about? Because I know once it's out there, it's like people can search it from then on, then forth.
Well, I think, you know, everyone when they first start writing, they're gonna stumble. And I think everyone knows that. I just think, so long as you don't take so long as you don't attack people, and you know, it's okay to have opinions and to be adversarial about about someone's position on a topic, but it's not okay to attack persons, individuals, right? Ad hominem attacks. So long as you maintain a kind of professional demeanor, I think you're fine, you know. One of the things that's myself and some of my colleagues have talked about, you know, we all have kind of interesting hobbies, you know, like myself, as I stated earlier today, I'm a shooter. A lot of people, that sets off alarm bells. They don't like it. And, you know, if I was working in California, I wouldn't talk about it because it could have negative repercussions in the workplace. But where I work right now, probably 25% of the people that I work with are hunters, or they, you know, they shoot self-defense type stuff. And so I'm fine with it, but I don't talk about it. It's not something that I would talk about using my personal blog or my personal platform that I talked about technology topics, because that has nothing to do with my technical expertise, right? So I think if you have hobbies like that it's important to keep the two separate, and there's actually quite a lot of there's quite a lot of research in the area of search engine results that shows that blogs which are focused in their content do better than blogs which are not. So, you know, it's probably a smart idea to maintain multiple Twitter accounts if you like to get into, you know, conversations with celebrities and that sort of stuff too. So, it's unfortunate that we have to compartmentalize our lives, but that's when you have, you know, gigantic search engines. One of the negative side effects, I guess.
So before Google, I used the Redbook. I don't know about you.
Yeah, Redbook's pretty good.
Yeah. So I'm sure a lot of us have been in the position of having, as you said, you have a bunch of short jobs on your resume, whether it's just that they had a layoff round and you were most recently in, you got kicked out, or it turned out not to be the right spot for you. How do you talk about those kinds of things on your resume where there might need to be a little bit of finessing, maybe?
Well, I will tell you that the reason why what we used to refer to as functional resumes are no longer popular, and in fact look quite negatively taken by most recruiters, is because of what we hear them say, hiding, yeah, you know, short jobs. Personally, I've had people ask me about it, and I'm sure that there's probably been cases where I haven't gotten job interviews because of it, but hiding it isn't going to get me anything. So, yeah, you know, people ask me about it when I'm in job interviews, and basically I just tell them, you know, I'm a grown-up. I know I was in a toxic work situation that I stayed in way longer than I should have, and I learned my lesson.
Yeah.
So if things are not working, I'm not going to, you know, waste my time and waste everybody else's time trying to fix something that is not fixable. And, you know, a reasonable organization is going to say, well, okay, I can understand that. That, you know, maybe that's not, you know, and because I have experience that is longer than 6 months or a year in kind of blocks around that short-term contract kind of stuff, you know, it's less worrisome because it shows that I have worked places longer than that. And so that, you know, maybe I really do know what I'm talking about, and I'm not the problem, you know. Okay. If, what is that quote that recently went around? If you meet one asshole, they're probably having a bad day, but if everybody you meet is an asshole, maybe you're the guy that has the problem. Yeah, so. Yeah. I think basically, you know, in your mind, be prepared to answer that question when you sit down at a job interview. Yeah. And, you know, there is no right or wrong answer for that. Some people might quiz you about specific jobs and why you left. And if that's the case, then you have to be prepared to answer those questions. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
I don't think there's any service in trying to hide it. So we have about 8 minutes left.
So going back one question to the ideas of public personas,
mm-hmm,
I think it depends a lot on where you are in your career. Because I was certainly very careful about what I put out for a very long time until I was confident that I'm pretty much going to be able to find a job. And now I find that putting my name out there associated with things like this, with public discussions of feminism, that sort of thing, ends up being a really good first filter on recruiters.
Wow, that's a good idea. I never thought about that. Yeah, I kind of wonder about recruiters. I mean, there are recruiters that that actually know how to use Google, and that's how they get their results. But there's also people who I think they just, there's a lot of them that still use this crazy shotgun style stuff, and and like corporate recruiters too. Not you know, there's multiple kinds of recruiters, right? There's executive slash headhunter recruiters who are given a flat fee. They're actually paid up front to go and find someone to fill a position. And then there are the recruiters that work for third-party agencies who work on spec. Basically, they get a commission when they fill a position. And they receive some cheesy salary, and that's like a bonus for them. And then there are the recruiters that you have internally in an organization. And recently, I received a cold job email from an internal recruiter at an organization, and it was just like really out there in left field, and I was just, it was flabbergasting that someone would, you know, send me a job that was so obviously not aligned with anything that I've done in the last decade. It was clearly a case of, you know, buzzword bingo, probably. They just typed in a term in LinkedIn and took the top 10 or 20 or 30 people and sent them a bunch of spam, and you know, that was that. You know, it's I think, you know, to talk about, to kind of come back to the topic of women versus men in the tech field, I think women have to be more careful on social media. Because of that whole pylon problem. And people are a lot more judgmental about our behavior than they are about men's behavior. Men, you know, it's the kind of boys will be boys attitude, and I think that's BS, but unfortunately, it's the reality that we have to deal with. So. All right, well, if there's not any other questions, cool.